Good morning, Your Honors. Ron Weldy of Weldy & Associates on behalf of Jill and Cody Treat, the appellants. And with me today is Jack Rockaby of Rockaby Law Offices. The issue that I'm here to speak to you this morning is a question of law as to whether wage claims that arise during the course of employment are governed by Indiana's wage payment statute or Indiana's wage claim statute. It's the position of the appellants, or the employees here, that based upon the language of the statute and the history of how these two statutes were passed by Indiana's General Assembly back in the 1930s, that in fact these wage claims accrue and are actionable pursuant to Indiana's wage payment statute, regardless of whether or not they were involuntarily terminated at some point in time later on in their employment.
You've been having difficulty getting any court to accept that argument. You've been in a number of courts to do that.
Well, Your Honor,
should we come out differently?
Your Honor, I briefed this to the Indiana Court of Appeals in three different cases, and now this is the first time to this court. The first time I briefed it was in the McCausland versus Walter USA case, which was decided, if my memory serves me correctly, December 27th of 2009. And in that case, in a footnote, the Court of Appeals, Indiana Court of Appeals, stated that Mr. McCausland, who had brought the vast majority of his claims were 10-day rule claims, which is specifically provided for in the wage payment statute, not in the wage claim statute, that he could bring those claims pursuant to the wage payment statute, and that his claim for commissions that weren't paid following his involuntary termination, in fact, fell underneath the wage claim statute. So in a footnote, the Indiana Court of Appeals agreed with the position being asserted by appellates today. There is some question as to whether or not that footnote has any controlling precedence in terms of trial courts. Unfortunately, it was not filed by two trial court judges shortly thereafter, which is
the Indiana Court of Appeals in that recent decision.
In the Gavin case. And I'll just address that very, very quickly. The Indiana Court of Appeals had to address that issue as a threshold legal issue in order to determine the scope of the remainder of their decision in the McCausland case. That case involved three different types of wages. It involved commissions, it involved multiple types of bonuses, and it involved vacation wages. The claims with regard to the bonuses and the vacation claims fell only under Indiana's only under the 10-day rule. And as such, if the Indiana Court of Appeals found that Mr. McCausland was unable to bring any claims pursuant to the wage payment statute because he had been involuntarily terminated, then those 10-day rule claims would have automatically evaporated because the wage claim statute simply has absolutely no language that compares to the wage to the 10-day rule underneath the wage payment statute. As such, by holding that he could bring claims pursuant to the wage payment statute, that made his 10-day rule claims meant that they could go forward, and ultimately the court could decide whether or not the commissions or bonuses in question were wages and whether or not the vacation pay had been timely paid or not.
Well, how do you reconcile the McCausland footnote with the Indiana Supreme Court's language in Steele?
Well, Judge, I don't have a problem with that whatsoever, because in Steele, the Supreme Court was not addressing this issue whatsoever. The only reason why the wage claim statute was brought up at all in the Steele case was because the defense, the St. Vincent, attempted to argue that Dr. Steele had to bring a claim, had to make a claim with the Department of Labor because the wages in question, the unpaid Medicaid wages that were at issue in that case, were quote-unquote disputed wages underneath 22.2-9-3, which is a section of the wage claim statute. The Supreme Court rejected that those wages fell underneath the label of disputed wages underneath the wage claim statute and automatically went back to the wage payment statute. I mean, Dr. Steele was a current employee of St. Vincent. He had not been separated at all, let alone involuntarily separated. So the fact that the wage claim statute was brought up at all in that case was simply some good lawyering on behalf of St. Vincent to try to get.
Right, but doesn't the Supreme Court's statement there give us a pretty clear indication that they want to divide the application of the statutes the way Judge Najem's opinion in the Gavin case held.
I don't see that, Your Honor. I mean, I think that they were categorizing how these statutes generally apply. I don't have any problems with those categorizations. They simply were not presented with the issue of wage claims that accrue during the course of employment that employee then becomes involuntarily separated and brings a cause of action underneath which statute should they be bringing that cause of action. That issue was simply not addressed in Steele. We have no reason to think that this Indiana Supreme Court was thinking about that issue when they generally discussed the application of these two different statutes. I mean, if you look at the actual history of these statutes, the wage payment statute was passed in 1933. And at some point in time, I, of course, not being alive in the 1930s, they realized, hey, wait a second, we made a mistake. We've covered wages that are paid out during the course of employment, and we've covered the payment of wages after a voluntary separation, but we've left this gap. We don't have a statute that covers the payment of wages after somebody's been involuntarily separated. And the way we would argue it, that specific payment of wages that's due upon separation of employment. So in 1939, the General Assembly fixes the gap. They pass the wage claim statute. And I don't think that they were really unhappy with the wage payment statute. I mean, for instance, they decided to use the damage provisions of the wage payment statute, specifically 22-5-2, as also the damages statute for the wage claim statute. They simply said to themselves, well, listen, people who have already lost their job, now they're having a double whammy. Now they don't get paid out some final wages they're owed. We ought to give these people some additional help. So they then allowed the Department of Labor, Indiana Department of Labor, to help them get their wages by setting up this referral process and also the ability for the Department of Labor to try to get those wages on behalf of those people.
When would the wage claim statute apply under your understanding of this scheme?
It happens all the time, Your Honor. I prosecute hundreds and hundreds of wage claims. You have vacation claims vacation that gets not paid out or is paid out late following an involuntary separation. You have people who do not receive their final wages, whether they be truck drivers receiving mileage or simply their final salary wages.
But these all arise out of their term of employment.
Well, Your Honor, the wage claim statute was specifically, by a specific language, says that the wages that are due and owing upon in the pay period for an involuntary separation must be paid on the agreed upon payday. So it's whatever wages should be paid on that final pay date the wage claim statute governs. So you're talking about final salary wages, final hourly wages, deferred compensation like vacation or personal time, anything like that, or potentially bonuses or commissions that are due after the termination.
Are we at the point that your co-counsel wants his minute?
Yes, Your Honor. So, thank you.
All right.
Good enough. If you have additional questions, obviously.
All right. I see none, so thank you. Ms. Martin.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, the affirmance of the District Court's decision in this case truly boils down to three simple points, the first of which is that there's no dispute that Jill and Cody Treat, the appellants in this case, were involuntarily terminated from their employment with Tom Kelly Buick Pontiac GMC. The second is, because of the Steele case, which this Court has discussed this morning, the Treats were required as involuntarily terminated employees to go through the procedural framework of the Indiana Wage Claim Statute. And third, complete the points necessary, it's undisputed that neither Jill Treat nor Cody Treat did so. And because of that particular chain of events and the statute which applies, it is appropriate to affirm the District Court's decision in this case. There was some discussion earlier during counsel's argument about the McCausland case, which was brought to the court's attention, the district court's attention, on the Treat's motion to reconsider. And as the district court noted with respect to that case, even reading it the most generously towards the appellants, it wouldn't reach the result that Jill and Cody Treat would seek, in that the amounts which were applied to the wage claim statute, which we assert that the Treats must go under, were the unpaid compensation, which is what they are seeking in this case. And so even the McCausland decision in separating out the wage payment statute and the wage claim statute as statutes which a terminated employee could proceed under, the wage claim statute's amounts were those unpaid compensation which we're looking at in this case.
And Ms. Burton, how workable do you think the distinction is between voluntary and involuntary termination? Anybody who works with employment law has seen plenty of instances where supervisor comes in and says it's time for you to be looking in a new direction, or is even more explicit, I need your resignation. In those kinds of situations, which statute applies under your theory?
Well, in the situation where someone has made the choice themselves, if there's any choice to be made, and would not be
I know there are easy cases.
Sure. So. Under the analysis that you're looking at is almost a constructive discharge idea. And though the Indiana courts have not necessarily looked at that specifically, I would imagine that practically a constructive discharge where the involuntary status of the termination might not apply would apply to the wage claim statute. A constructive discharge would apply to the wage claim statute.
It sounds like that would let an employer say, well, it was a voluntary termination because we got your resignation. But when somebody then turns around and sues for vacation pay and so on, they say, well, because we asked for it, now it was a constructive discharge, therefore you had to go to the Department of Labor, it's too late, and you lose. It becomes a trap, right?
Well, you know, and as I said, the Indiana courts have not necessarily looked at that point of it, but one public policy reason I think that can't be overlooked is that the idea of providing the wage claim statute to an involuntarily terminated employee provides the opportunity for the Indiana Department of Labor to serve as that buffer between perhaps disgruntled employee and the employer from whom they might be seeking their wages. And as a public policy matter, the Indiana Department of Labor is well positioned to take that step on behalf of the employee and perhaps monitor what, in fact, proceeds to court.
Would you agree with me, though, that in the constructive discharge situation, the position you're taking creates the potential for a trap for an employee who has resigned at request, so that he or she may not know whether they have to go to the Department of Labor before they pursue their rights?
I can see how the constructive discharge theory might lead to that, and I can see how the Indiana courts may ultimately determine that it is simply, for that reason, it is simply the employee's status as were you on paper an employee who resigned or was terminated, because that...
With a bright line.
Right, that may be a reason to adopt that sort of a test. And it appears that another thing I think to keep in mind with respect to the distinction between the McCausland case and even the Harney case that was argued to the district court is that in those cases there is no analysis of whether or not that particular plaintiff brought a claim to the Indiana Department of Labor, whereas in this recent Gavin case, that is front and center in the court's opinion and pivotal in determining that Mr. Gavin's claims were to be dismissed because he didn't go through the procedural framework of the Indiana Department of Labor.
Ms. Martin, let me ask you, if we get on to the merits here, if plaintiffs can overcome the threshold problem here, one of the issues that was controversial in the district court is whether the plaintiffs' errata sheets, as for their depositions, would be admissible. I understood the district court to be saying no. How do you reconcile that position with the language of Rule 30E1B, which clearly allows changes in form or substance to deposition transcripts.
Well, I think that one problem that the district court noted in dealing with those errata sheets and over several pages of the opinion that analysis went was that Ms. Treat, and it was her errata sheets that were really the bulk of what the court was looking at, she didn't give a reason why those changes were made. And the court seemed to put some emphasis on that point, that these rather voluminous additions to her testimony or clarifications or refinements were made without providing any reason.
Would you agree that if a reason is given, a change in substance is permissible under the rule?
Again, I think I would have to look at what the courts have said with respect to these errata sheets, that they are not a take-home examination. And that
How is this any different, though? I mean, I know that's a clever phrase to describe the situation, but how is that any different from coming back in the afternoon of a day-long deposition and telling the questioner, turns out I made a mistake this morning, and that meeting that we talked about wasn't on the first of the month, it was on the 10th of the month. Is that a problem?
I think it still could be a problem.
It's not allowed?
Well, in this particular setting with Ms. Treat, there was also argument with respect to the different pieces of testimony that she sought to submit via errata sheet, that not only was she trying to add testimony to what she was already saying, but in fact she had been asked later on in the deposition, given the opportunity to, you know, you've had the chance to think about it some more, is there anything else that you want to add? I think in some situations that still would be a problem because of questions like that or the opportunity to develop.
A problem in terms of you can be impeached with the different answers and that it might have taken the third question to get the answer, or a problem as in it's not admissible in light of Rule 30E.
Well, I think in this case it would fall more on the side of it's not admissible, in that the court and the way that other district courts have handled that similar type of situation would be to strike an errata response for that reason.
But is that permissible given the language in the rule that allows changes in substance if you give a reason?
I would agree that there would be circumstances where a change in substance could be possible, but would disagree that would be possible in the case at bar with what.
So some changes in substance are allowed and some are not.
Well, I think in some situations, deponents will realize that there was a different word or the name of a different person. There are all sorts of changes in substance that might be appropriate. But I think what it boils down to is this was such a lengthy and extensive rewriting of the entire piece of testimony that made the difference in this case, and I think might make the difference in other similar cases. And by the same token, with respect to the appeal regarding the evidentiary issues, and we would, of course, assert that there is no live issue because the wage claim statute applies and bars the Treat's claims. However, we would also indicate that the reasons provided to the district court by the appellees for striking that evidence were reasonable, not arbitrary, and that the district court's decision on that point should be upheld.
All right, thank you. How much time left? 1 minute.
Your Honors, if I might, it's not that I don't appreciate the opinion of this court, but as you can tell by the history of the briefing of this, in front of the Indiana Court of Appeals and now this court, it is our position that this particular issue is one that needs to be addressed by the Indiana Supreme Court, and the quicker the better. And the real reason for that is, if I was defense counsel representing employers, I would argue that underneath the Gavin case, that any claim that arises during the course of employment evaporates upon termination of that employment. And that's a pretty huge thing, if you think about
metamorphosis.
It.
Metamorphosis.
Well, Your Honor, I don't have any reason.
Claim under the wage claim.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, the in 22.2-9-4, subsection A, it says, it shall be the duty of the Commissioner of Labor to enforce and ensure compliance with the provisions of this chapter. The Department of Labor doesn't have any enforcement responsibilities with regard to the wage payment statute. By statute, it only has enforcement compliance with the wage claim statute. So unless there's some way to read in all those claims that arise underneath the wage payment statute, the Department of Labor doesn't have any jurisdiction over those. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks to both counsel, and we'll take that case under advisement.